Yeah, automation, but now usually try and help everybody, share. So, to tell the story of the suicidal spider, just to wake people up. You know the story of the suicidal spider? Oh, there was the, somewhere in London, there was a little spider that was just freshly born, made a beautiful little web in the corner of somebody's house. And it made such a lot of effort, really mindful, very sort of diligent, and made this amazing web in the corner of somebody's house. And as soon as she was finished, she was exhausted. She sat in the middle of the web, waiting for lunch. And of course, lunch never came, because the owner of the house saw a spider in the corner of the room, and with the broom, whacked the web, and the spider had to run for her life. It came so close to it being killed. And so, what could you do? She had to go to the next house and build another web. And again, it was destroyed. A third house, the fourth house, the fifth house, the sixth house, the seventh house. And after seven houses, this poor spider was so exhausted, and so hungry, and so traumatized. It had post-traumatic spider syndrome. And it started thinking, nobody loves spiders. Why? I mean, spiders don't do any harm. I just want to spread a little web in the corner of your room. There's plenty of space for everyone else. And also, we just take the bus, which you don't want. We do a service for you. So you don't have to break your precepts, I break your precepts for you by getting rid of the bus. But why do you hate me so much? And so the spider, it not only got traumatized, even the thought of building a web in somebody's house made it shake. And had all these flashbacks of brooms and running for her life. And so poor little spider, she was walking down the road in London, thinking, no one loves spiders. No one appreciates us. I'm homeless. I've got no place I can go. And everybody just, I'm so hungry and so alone. She became suicidal. And there was no helpline she could call. No place she could go for refuge. And so she thought, this is hopeless. So she became a suicidal spider. She decided to try and crawl under somebody's feet, try and get squashed by them. But every time that she tried to walk under somebody's shoes, always made the space between the heels and the sole. That didn't work. So she decided to cross the road and get squashed under a lorry. Always got between the tyres, they're actually underneath them. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're really depressed, you can't do anything right. Not even suicide. So a poor suicidal spider was really, really, really depressed. And then, she was walking down the road, like a drunkard, driving around, not knowing where she was going. And that's when she felt someone looking at her. You ever had that feeling? You're walking down, minding your business, and think someone's looking at you. So she turned around, and she saw the fattest, happiest spider she'd ever seen in her whole life. And the big, fat, happy spider was looking at her, and said, why are you so sad? And that was the invitation for suicidal spider to tell the short, tragic story of her life. How she was born, went into a corner of a house and made a beautiful web, and it was destroyed. And then another house and another house, and life was so difficult. And every now and again, the big jolly spider had to get a tissue out so she could wipe her eyes, and she was telling a sad story about what had happened to her. And when she came to the very end of her story, she said, no one loves me. And that's when the big jolly fat spider looked at her and said, well, you know, why didn't you come and stay with me? And the suicidal spider looked at the jolly fat spider and said, "Hey, how come you're not thin? How come you're so happy? Didn't people destroy your webs?" "No." Big jolly fat spider said, "I only built one web, and it's still there. No one disturbs me. There's plenty of food, but there's plenty of food for both of us. Why don't you come and stay with me?" And the suicidal spider said, "Where in the whole of London can you build a web, build and get lots of food without ever getting disturbed? And the jolly fat spider said, "Oh, easy. I build my web and it's still there, get plenty of food. I build my web in the donation box of the Buddhist temple." No one ever disturbed me. So there's plenty of space there for the donations as well as the scribes, don't worry.
And with your eyes closed, just bring attention to how you are sitting on your chair. To get yourself comfortable. Now you may assume that you are comfortable, but you can do better than this. So start by focusing on your feet on the floor. Do you need to move your feet further out from the chair, further in, spread them out? Are they comfortable? If you do try to adjust your feet on the floor, you need mindfulness first of all, awareness of how you feel, just in that one area of your body. And also awareness of when you move them, whether it improves the comfort. Mindfulness allows you to have feedback. So you can feel whether you need to adjust. And that's the best position. Not only is this going to give you a comfortable posture to sit in, it's also going to mean that you are developing this awareness of kindness, mindfulness of compassion, in your own body first of all. And build it up as you go through this very quick body scan. You go up from your feet to your rest of your legs. How do your legs feel now? Sometimes this is some tightness or tension there. You can notice it. Zoom in on that area. You may have some pain or tension in your knees or in your thighs. Be aware of it. And if moving can help relax that part of the body, then just move, adjust. But when you are moving, adjusting that part of your body, always notice the feedback, whether you are more comfortable or less comfortable. And obviously out of compassion, go to the most comfortable part. And sometimes, even if it's not moving it, you can focus on that part of the body and learn how to relax the tightness of tension in that part of the body. Sometimes parts of the body are just like stretched, like a guitar string is stretched under stress. You can imagine just loosening both ends of the guitar string. Like viewing the muscles in your body, relaxing them, loosening them, and being aware of how it changes the feeling in that part of your body. You're aware. Is that the best position for your back now? If you do move, adjust, and find it's an improvement. Now you can go to your hands. How's your hands positioned? Can you maintain that position comfortably for the next 20 minutes? So you focus awareness on different parts of the body. Learn how to relax them. There's no tightness in that part of the body at all. Everything is loose and open and free. And you can go up the arms, through especially your shoulders. People do have aches and pains in their shoulders because of tightness. So I often imagine both sides of my spine, the shoulders, a whole bundle of strings being stretched at each end. I imagine just letting go of those ends. I can feel the muscles in my shoulders. They relax too. And I go up to my neck, the other sore neck or my cough. Sometimes that's due to allergies, hay fever, colds. If it's inside the throat, you can do a lot just by focusing on that area and giving it massive amounts of kindness. A big dose of vitamin C, vitamin compassion. To your own throat. There we go, it works. Thank you. And then we go up to our face. The face is a good indicator of your emotions. If you are tight, tense, angry, depressed, you can see that on the person's face. So see if you can relax. Aware of those muscles and any tightness. See what you need to do. To relax the muscles around the mouth and the arms and the forehead. Because we do notice, again, the feedback principle. You notice whether the tightness gets loosened or whether it gets more tight. Find what works, how to relax parts of your own body. Roughly the center of your brain. Imagine the tiredness as well, of your poor brain. Just have to work so hard. Imagine that loosening, relaxing, nothing pulling or stretching your brain. Imagine it like the rest of your body, relaxing to the max. Now you can be aware of your whole body sitting here, at ease. Relax as much as you possibly can. If you want to go back to one part which is still irritating, please do so. See if you get it more relaxed. And at any time during this meditation, try to cough. You cough straight away. It's finished with. If you plug it up, you get what we call in meditation volcano effect. You really cough up. In peace. It's called letting go. Keep your awareness on this peace monitor. How peaceful you are, how agitated. notice the breath as it comes in, wherever, however it comes in. And just know it as it goes out. The natural rhythm of the breath. And if it helps, as you're breathing in, start to notice the delight, the happiness, the mind which is experiencing some peace. And the delight of a relaxed body, the delight of a peaceful mind. Focus on the peace answer and then how to relax it. Find the problem straight forward because you know it. You're very peaceful and happy. You don't need to think. You don't fight the thoughts. Find the cause behind them. The lack of contentment, the lack of inner peace, the lack of inner happiness. Coming close to the end of meditation. Turn on and look how relaxed your body is and how peaceful your mind. And ask why. Why is your mind peaceful? And why is it not peaceful? So at least in every meditation, we know we grow in peace and in kindness. Stand up and have a good stretch.
Well, sometimes when you get old, you look creepy. And sitting down for half an hour, Penny became in earlier. Oh, it just gets you nice. Okay, so it makes it much easier for you to listen to the talk. Okay, well, Anthony, is that Australian time or is that New Stanford summer time? Okay, so the title of today's talk is going to do with not me, not mine, not a self. It's one of those teachings about emptiness, anatta. But I always like to start off with a Buddhist joke, because in order for the Dhamma to be able to accommodate itself, especially to Western culture, in Western culture, humour is an important part of teaching. So, we have the three characteristics of existence, the anatta, dukkha, anatta. You know those ones? Anatta is myself, dukkha, suffering, anatta, impermanence. So anatta, dukkha, anatta, walk into a pub. That's culturally appropriate to the land in which we are sitting. Anatta, dukkha, anatta, that's impermanence, suffering and yourself. Walk into a pub. And dukkha says, this pub sucks. Anatta says, don't worry, it will change. Anatta replied, who said that? Silly child. There's nothing wrong with being silly. Because sometimes why a thing is so serious. So sometimes it's wonderful if we can let go, which is part of not me, not mine, not myself business. So, I don't know about the management of this joint, but I've got many places which I'm supposed to be managing over in Australia and other places too. And you know, it can be quite stressful. So it's okay for you. You just come in here, listen to my talk, you go out afterwards. Wonderful. Same with me. I'm just what they call in Australia, blowing. Come in from Australia and about another 10 days' time go away again. In Western Australia, I call them mushrooms. Then, what else do we have? Oh, yeah, and over in Victoria, Sydney, and so forth. And then you've got the overseas ones. There's so many stuff. So, there came a time when I would go to our centre in Perth on the weekend. Teach all day. And sometimes it is all day. And then you go back to your monastery. And then teach. So I had two main jobs, a weekend job and a sort of a weekday job. And the other people don't get paid. That's the worst part of it. So being a monk or a nun, it's just the pay is terrible. I like sort of confronting stories. There's this man, he's from Yorkshire, his name is Ted. He was in a local hospice in Australia with cancer, he was dying, lung cancer I think. And basically just admitted to die 5 or 6 days at most. And then he told me that the nurse came in one evening and said, what do you want to have for dinner tonight, Ted? And he said, well, look, I've got diabetes, I can't have anything sugary. He said, and I've got sort of
cholesterol, high cholesterol. I can't have anything oily. And I've got hardened arteries. I can't have anything salty. He went on like this. And the nurse was looking at him. She said, Ted, what are you talking about? You're not going to die of cholesterol or diabetes or heart failure. You're going to die of cancer in about 5 or 6 days. You can eat whatever you want. And Ted's eyes are pounding and went, why? What? I need all this oily, syrupy, salty food, which I've been allowed to eat for years? Yeah, go for it. So Ted has some of his favourite, delicious, unhealthy food. So they said unhealthy, which you haven't been allowed for years and years and years. You know what happened? About 6 days later, he walked out of that hospice in remission, and another 6 months before he had to return again and die properly. The worry was killing him. Remember that even with food and exercise, it's not just the body, it's also the mind and the heart as well. One of my icons I always try to live up to, someone I knew when I was young, who was just always so kind, so generous, someone I really looked up to, and I thought, you know, I would like to be like this very spiritual person when I grow old. And you know, he was old when I was young, and he's still alive today. It's amazing. And always healthy, always happy, always so generous. And I've seen him here in London recently. Santa. Santa Claus. Jolly, happy, and anyway, let's go back to Avatar. I'll move on to something. Oh, being a visitor. Being a visitor blesses your life. You're a visitor to your body. This body doesn't really belong to you. It does belong to nature, not to you. And if you're a visitor to this body, you make the best use of it. You're always ready to let it go when it's time to let it go. A doctor. I saw one of the little photographs of him, and going through old photographs, when he was a young kid, offering stuff to the monks. And very bright young man, did well at school, went to university, became a doctor, and when he graduated, he started working in the hospitals. Very brilliant fellow. The day came when he came up to me, and he said that he had to resign. He said he couldn't carry on being a doctor any longer. And I was wondering why. He was still young. It was only about 2 years he'd been a doctor. And he said to me that very morning, one of his patients had died tragically. It was a young woman of about 23. The death was unexpected. It wasn't his fault, but he felt so guilty, especially when he had to be the one to have to tell her husband, who was still in the beginnings of their marriage together, that the wife, the one he chose above all others, the one he loved so much, had died. And as if to rub salt into the wound, as the saying goes, the two young children have no money. It was unexpected. And that just, you can imagine, just the shock and the desperation and the why of that young family. And he felt responsible. And he said, I can never do that again. I can never be the one who says that verbal gifts to this little family. It broke him. He said, I have to resign. And that's where I mentioned to him something else more important. This is also a part of not mine. He felt responsible. It was his fault. So instead I told him that he misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor, being a nurse, being a therapist, being a counselor, or just being a good friend. Your purpose is never to cure. You'll never be able to succeed. Temporary cures may be, but most of the time you'll come across diseases and problems which don't have a cure. If you think that curing is your purpose in life, you will fail many times and you will go through the same tragedy and pain because you couldn't cure them. The job of a doctor is not to cure the patients. Just change one letter. The job is to care for them. If you care for your patients, you care for your friends, you care for your family, you never need to fail. You can't always cure them. You can always care for them. If you make caring more important than curing. Number one, you're not trying to control people anymore. You're caring for them. And also, you're not trying to demand they get better. You're not trying to force them to change their ways. You're caring for them. You'll always be a success. You can always care. And imagine how that will change the outcomes. If you make caring one more than curing, you will find that even if somebody does die, they die having been cared for. And that changes the whole picture. How many times at the end of life do people have these very intrusive interventions trying to keep people going for a little bit longer? Because curing is far more important to number one society than care. How many times you have a relationship with somebody and try to cure your partner of their bad habits? What happens? They get worse. You try to care for them. And then those habits tend to get less. By caring, you're not controlling or owning your the opposite, being kind, compassionate, free. So, I care for the monastery of Thailand, but I don't own it. You know the difference there. You know the difference to having a place where you can enjoy it. You can enjoy being the boss. You enjoy being the head of Amakampa. Because you're caring for it. Never try to cure all the different problems which will come up from time to time. If the UK government would care rather than curing all the problems of the economy, the problems with crime, the problems with Europe, the problems with anything, care instead of curing. And you get people working together. So your body doesn't belong to me, but I care for it. But it will try and cure it. Oh, let us have it, so. Let go. So anyway, we started the meditation by caring for your body, letting it go. Realizing you don't control this body. It's not yours. It belongs to nature. My job is just to care for it. Next, even my, what else are you proud of? Not just your body, but also your intelligence. You know something that I'm already in decline I'm already over the hill. Even all the stuff which I used to know, I don't know anymore. And so, more and more, my disciples are catching me out. I shall run. The Buddha never said that. It doesn't matter. You know what a wonderful thing is? It's okay to be wrong. What a wonderful thing that is to actually admit your faults and also not to be embarrassed or ashamed when we make mistakes. Why is it that people have got such big egos and pride? They know they've made a mistake, but they will not admit it. And of course you come across that, you know, just in relationships, in life. People will not back down, which is part of their thing they own, their intelligence, and they own their sort of being right. Sometimes I don't wonder why is it that people argue? And one of the reasons is because we were taught, I was taught anyway, go back to school, that if you make a mistake, there's something terribly wrong with you. You're not allowed to make a mistake. Do better next time. Come home earlier. Don't say the same stupid thing. And we're so afraid of making mistakes that we don't admit them anymore. So, as if we're not allowed to have to own our being rightness. There's nothing wrong with being wrong. It's quite nice to be wrong, every now and again. So, my big mistake, what are the sort of things which I've done wrong? I've had a time. One of my big mistakes which I made was, you know, that in Buddhism they have to go and do some chanting every now and again, and just to help people. It was just like football. You go chanting for your football team. It actually helps. And you know, people do better. Otherwise, you know, why do you have home games and away games? So, it works for football teams, but maybe it might work for temples. Go, Bermondsey! But, there's also when people go and they get sick. You do a bit of chanting, that's actually just encourage them, inspiration. It's also got another deeper level as well. A bit of a psychic sort of stuff. And I remember just this, there was this Chinese family, and their patriarch was very sick in the ICU in a coma. So they asked me to go do some chanting for them. And the family had come over from Hong Kong and Singapore and Taiwan. And so I went into the ICU and I really did some really put on chanting. Gave everything I've got. All power. Zap, zap, zap. The Buddhist chanting. Oh, I really gave it 100%. And it worked. The fellow actually came out of the coma and it started getting better. And that is when the shit hit the fan. The other thing, can you do the shit hit the fan? And straight away, if anybody ever complains that monks should not use the shit word, I will point out to you, it's in the Buddha's teachings, that you should teach in the local language. Anyway. So, what happened was, it started getting better. And that's when the whole family really started scolding me. He said, now we've already arranged a funeral service. It's not getting better. And they already arranged a funeral service. Everybody had come from overseas, taking part of their businesses, flying all away all this way. And now because of you, Asakwa, your Buddhist chanting, now we have to go back again, cancel the funeral, and we can probably have to come back in 6 months when he starts again. We're not going to invite you. Because I told him, look, you should have told him beforehand. what type of charter do you want? The get ever charter, or my peacefully charter. So if you ever want the Venables here to do some charting for you, please ask the watch charter you want. The happy marriage, or get divorced quick charging. So yeah, you make this nothing wrong with being wrong. It's being human. Now that is something which is also part of oneself. You have an ego. It's very fixed. And you can't change, you can't be wrong. You can't make mistakes. That's not who you are. You have to be the expert. You have to be beautiful. You have to always be the champion of the world. Whatever it is. That's part of the self which causes us a lot of suffering. So one day you're right, this is my being right day. Tomorrow is my being wrong day. Otherwise, it's also, we're not innovative either. We're afraid of making mistakes because it might hurt our sense of self, our ego. No innovation, no courage, no daring, no trying to do something a bit different, just to see. Many times you may fall on your face if you make a mistake. Now you get lots of this experience, it's called forward failing. You're not afraid, because you don't have to always be right. You don't always have to be successful. You'll always be learning, growing, innovating. So when we have a very fixed fear of thinking of ourselves, not a fear of failure, we always tend to want to live up to what other people expect of us. In prison, we're not free anymore. Because sometimes your sense of self is what other people impose on you. Who you're supposed to be. That's not what a monk should be doing. That's not what a girl should do. That is not what, I don't know, what a politician is supposed to do. But sometimes you should do it. See what happens. It feels right at the time. You're coming from the heart, not from all these ideas of who you're supposed to be. All these measurements. This is where a lot of the sense of self and mind is. And people measure themselves by how much they possess. How much do you love and control? How many degrees have you got? When I was in Cambridge, I had this very wonderful graffiti. Exam. Killed by degrees. The eminence of a great scientist. This was at the Cambridge Laboratory. The eminence of a great scientist is measured by the length of time he or she stops progress in their field. The bigger their ego, the more they stop progress in innovation. And the sense of self is an obstacle. So anyway, what we actually do is learn how to not measure ourselves. You know, we live in a society, even in London, with cameras, more CCTV cameras than in London, than even in China, or is it China or Kenya? Why have we got CCTV cameras everywhere? Measuring, getting biometric data, getting all sorts of data, judging, measuring so many things. Someone asked me about that many years ago, because they were referring to one of the founders of the Industrial Revolution here in England. A fellow called Lord Kelvin. Any engineers here will know Lord Kelvin was the person whose name now stands on the Carolus scale of temperature, which is by far the most logical. Zero is absolute zero, and it's 273 degrees Kelvin. 273 degrees Kelvin is 0 degrees centigrade. So this was a logical temperature scale, because he was somebody who was saying that if you want to control nature, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first. I don't know why they use the female gender for nature there. But anyway, that's what he said, his quote. Learn to measure, and then you will be able to control. And that was the start of the industrial revolution, where we had to have good, accurate clocks to measure time. Accurate measurements of the kilogram, apparently just changed it, just adjusted it. No one will ever notice it. Standard weights and measures and time, because once you can measure things, then you can control them. Now we've seen that philosophical understanding, scientific knowing that this is what you need to do to control nature. But it also means we can use that to control people as well. We can control ourselves. What happens if you stop measuring? If you stop measuring, there's no way of controlling anymore. You have to let go. Compassion is not measuring. May I be happy and well, no matter what. May I be at peace, no matter what. The door of my heart is open to all beings, all traditions, all genders, no matter what. Not measuring. And people ask, that's a problem. Why too young? Tell me about what tradition I have. I change from day to day. And it's just your life. I'm not going to measure. If I have a tradition at all, a Buddhist tradition, you know what tradition it is. You try, first of all, try and amalgamate, join things together, for goodness sake. Stop separating stuff. So I decided to take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana, to put them all together. And that became my tradition. You've already got it, haven't you? So what's my tradition? I think I just joined it. Stuck. So I decided to take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana, to put them all together. And that became my tradition. You've already got it, haven't you? So what's my tradition? I think I just joined it. Mahayana.
Mahayana.
Mahayana was the same one. The good half, you're so bad. Why are we measuring, trying to put walls and barriers between people? And between wisdom. And between, I don't know, truth. Because measuring is something which the sense of self wants to do. I am better, I am worse, I am the same. The three Buddhist conceits. When I saw that, I thought, wow, that's really cool. Are you better than others? Are you worse? Everyone the same? How many of you were Monty Python fans? Monty Python, you know, right before I... Now, it came to my mind again recently because I'll finish up soon. It's not my fault. So anyway, the fellow who was one of the main writers of Monty Python, especially the life of Brian, Eric Idle, he was the one who wrote and sang the song "Look on the Bright Side of Life." You know, in many Buddhist funeral services, now that's actually played a lot. It's one of the few religious movies which Max was allowed to watch. And in that movie, there was Brian, who's supposed to be the Messiah. And so they asked his mother, and he said, Brian, you know, is he the Messiah? He said, no, he's just a naughty boy. Remember that, right? Yeah, so the vice chancellor of Adelaide University, where Eric Idle was awarded, this was a couple of weeks ago, he was awarded an honorary PhD by Adelaide University. Great PR, isn't it? Avoid somebody who's famous for PhD, and of course you get the newspapers going there, and the media. And so the vice chancellor, in his dedication speech, said, "But actually, he's not really a PhD. He's just a little naughty boy." But being kind to them, pardon the door of my heart is open to you, no matter how I measure you. I'm not why I'm measuring you. Are you measured? Yes, sir. Of course you are. Do you stack up? No, there's always lots of faults. You measure yourself. How good are you? It's one of the nice things about myself. I'm not able to measure you. Who the heck am I? Am I a good man or a bad man? Am I just... am I enlightened? Or am I just a naughty boy? Notice that, whatever you aspire for in life, you can see it, it's right in front of you, you go towards it, and it moves away from you. Whether it's perfect relationship, enlightenment, peace, meaning, you see it. You go towards it, it moves away. Like the donkey and the carrot. And the donkey chooses to spend their whole lives chasing carrots and die before they ever got one. All the things which you know, it's right in front of you, like enough money, enough good respect from your colleagues, whatever else you measure and think is important in your life. You ever see this right here in front of you, move towards it and move away. Just always get them, but never quite. But then, one day, a donkey was just tethered outside the temple in Birmingham, and he heard the Dhamma and found out how to catch carrots. Very easy when you figure it out. The donkey was running after the carrot as fast as he possibly could. Just like people in London, chasing the buck, chasing fame, chasing fortune, chasing disciples, whatever else you're chasing. And the more you chase them, the more distant they are. But this time, the donkey decided to stop. To let go. Stop measuring. Just be. So the donkey stops. What happens to the carrot? That carrot swung further away from the donkey. Swung 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. And the donkey just stood there. And the carrot, at the end of its trajectory, started swinging back towards the donkey. And soon that carrot was in its normal position, 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. But this time, travelling at high speed towards the donkey's mouth. But soon it swung right back, didn't chase it, only been chasing for too long. Just stopped, the carrot went far away, came right back again, and the last thing it needed to remember, it's not just stillness and stopping, it's also kindness, compassion. So just before the carrot would hit the donkey's teeth, the donkey thought, compassion. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open. Now measuring afterwards involves responsibilities and business. I'm not good enough. The world is not good enough. There's a space for that. But there's a time, especially for you, when you say, I'm not good enough, I'm not successful enough, I'm not healthy enough, I'm not happy enough, I'm not mind enough. And we stop. That's a special to meditation. Stop. And when you don't measure even progress in your meditation, you don't own your meditation, you don't own your mind. And you don't own your body. Just be a visitor. Visitor to your idea of self. Do not measure it. Then you become so peaceful. Are you good? Are you bad? You stop measuring. You just are. And all your perceptions, if you want what and take from others, have never been good enough, never been successful enough, never been beautiful enough, never been healthy enough. All those vanish. When they vanish, you stop chasing things. You stop chasing things, all those things you wanted to chase and achieve, they come to you. Pretty radical in this teaching. You don't strive. You stop striving, comes from measuring, controlling. Stop it. Please, kindness. Kindness to yourself. I'm really good enough. So I really bristle against self-improvement. Who the hell told you you're not good enough anyway? You need to improve. How do they know? Are you good enough? Are you? Do you believe me? A lot of times people come to places like this. What was that story about the person who went to the bookshop? And they asked the person at the counter, "Can you please tell me, where is the self-help section?" And the person on the counter said, "So if I told you, it would defeat the purpose." Self-help, well, I love yourself. And even worse, self-improvement. It's always all predicated on measuring. I say, somehow, you're not good enough. And you believe that. And then your life is, it's not good enough. And to overcome that, that 12 people are similarly as a forest. Then you get so much wisdom living in forests or jungles, like London. See how people behave, how they live. For this particular case of living in a forest, you know, all those years I've lived as a forest monk, now I live in a forest over in Australia. I've never, ever, ever seen a perfect tree. Not in the conventional sense of perfect, being dead straight, with all the branches equally straight, with all green leaves, no yellow leaves or brown leaves, and no leaves which have been munched by insects, no trees which have been damaged by the storms or the fires. I've never seen a perfect tree, not in the sense of, you know, undamaged. In fact, I'm not diseased. In fact, if I did, I don't think I'd appreciate it. My favourite trees in the forests, the ones which are all twisted and bent. She's got lots of yellow leaves and brown leaves, and where? Because of the storms, many big branches have fallen off. In the holes, that's where the birds, or in Australia, things like possums, that's where they make their nests. Without those, they'd be homeless. All the twisty ones and bent ones, and all these little cankers and bumps on their trunk. That's what makes them look beautiful. The damaged ones. So I remember telling a group of people who've been traumatized by life, if you are damaged goods, number one, you belong. You belong to this beautiful forest called humanity. And number two, this is one of my favourite trees. The twisted, the bent, the damaged ones. Just stop finding good of yourself. Embrace yourself.
as belonging. It doesn't need to be fixed up. It just needs to be appreciated and loved. That's how we stop measuring. What is it like, you know, that for the LGBTQIA plus, because of the matters I learned in Australia, how does it feel? What's it like being gay 20, 30 years ago? There's something wrong with you. It can be fixed. How many times do people feel that? So many different parts of their life. And I'm not saying that's good, and that's really ridiculous. That causes so much harm. Measuring. I've been measuring, never being good enough. Never being good enough leads to more control. It's so much problems. Schizophrenia. I am very happy to say that we've got at least three clinical schizophrenics as monks in the Monastery in Australia.
I'm wondering how to deal with if you have bad habits that damage yourself or others, or addictions, and not wanting to change.
Not wanting to change, because sometimes people are forced to change. Why do people have addictions? One of the things is that, you know, the lack of self-control, they feel so bad about themselves anyway. To make them feel more bad about themselves, it just makes it worse. Addictions, say, being mothered on the grown, or are they supposed to get less? What are we doing with addictions? Whether it's drugs, alcohol, other sort of stuff which people get addicted to. Why? There's something going wrong there in our way of understanding what these things are and why they keep on happening. So many times, because maybe it's my job, that a lot of people are actually talking in depth about their addictions. Nothing seems to be working that much. But one of the great ways is being associated with good people, even associated with fellow recovery addicts. You can find there's nothing wrong with you. That's the first thing, to stigmatize. To stigmatize a person, that just reinforces that they're not good enough and they get more addicted. Maybe give up one addiction and get another one. Even like things like the Buddha said in meditation, thinking. I just mentioned that. The biggest problem when people try to meditate, I try to meditate, I think too much, my thoughts are all out of control. Why? Are they really out of control? Yes. No one can control thinking. Control causes more thinking. Let it go, be kind. Then it stops. And even better, I was born in London, English, so as soon as, in those days anyway, my generation, as soon as you were weaned off your mother's milk, you were on cushion tea. And this was smack bang up in the mountains in the middle of a tea plantation. Heaven! As much tea as I can possibly want to drink. And beautiful caves, cool climate, good food, no one bothering you. This was the perfect place to meditate. You know what happened after 3 or 4 weeks? I started to have so many thoughts. And the thoughts got worse and worse. And the more I tried to control them, the worse they got. And they weren't just ordinary thoughts. These were what I called unmonkish thoughts. I wonder if that old girlfriend is still available. I'm not only 29 at the time, but I'm still sort of young and there. Good degree, I can do anything from this time. But now I want to be a mouse, shut up. I wonder if that one's available. I know, shut up.
then suddenly all this romantic fantasy, and I watched it, I was going crazy. And I just went up to the shrine, there was a Buddha statue there, I just bowed to the Buddha and asked for help. And I got an inspiration. Do a deal. This is the problem with this one, do a deal. And the deal was this, it made sense to a Western mind. For all the day I would be a good monk, I would just watch my text, be good. The next hour I could watch every person without missing one. And what's going on? Then I let go. My mind is so peaceful. When I'm controlled.
Those words, the monster grew bigger and more frightening and more acrid and more smelly and more violent. And every unkind word, unkind act, unkind thought even, the monster grew bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time that Her Majesty came back into the palace, this monster was so huge, like a fellow called Yaga the Frankenstein, ugly and yucky, and the stench, the smell coming off the body of this monster in the Queen's throne in Buckingham House. The smell was so bad that even the maggots crawling on his skin. Even they vomited. As soon as the Queen, Her Majesty, came in, all of her training, her wisdom, all of her good karma to make it as a queen, she knew straight away what to do. She said to this terrifying monster, "Welcome. Thank you so much for dropping by. Has anyone offered you a cup of tea?" We have many types of tea in this palace. We have Earl Grey, we have Darjeeling, we have green tea, we've got all sorts of tea here. Hello, since you. I said, "Well, we've got a sandwich yet. We have cucumber sandwiches." It's not a cucumber sandwich, it's not that unusual. Anyway, what do you want? And at that sincere act of kindness, the monster started growing smaller. The smell got less, the violence got less, and the ugliness got less. And that meant all the people in the palace.
This is great. I'm going to ask you the last question.
Can an enlightened being decide to come back for the benefit of the disciples?
Can an unenlightened being...
No, enlightened.
An enlightened being decide. Not even an unenlightened being can decide for themselves. Okay. We all go according to the causes and effects, conditions, frameworks, by our culture, by our teachers, by our understanding. Basically, we may think we have choice. We don't.
Not even enlightened
beings. Enlightened beings don't have choice at all. Okay, the master said to their disciples, the disciples said, "Can you give me some quick advice about going out?" He said, "Never argue with an idiot." And the disciples said, "That's not compassionate." The master said, "Yeah, I agree with you."